The Hiyor drew his hand back, ready to slam his axe blade into the deck. No! I sent in an urgent blade of psychic warning. To drive a weapon into the ground before a brother was to initiate a blood challenge, a Chthonian gang ritual that Abaddon had allowed, even encouraged, to spread through our warbands. Lahior's face twitched as his cranial implants reacted with boiling heat to the unwanted pressure of my silent voice in his mind. But it was enough to force a moment's hesitation. He lowered the blade. The watching crowd bayed their disappointment. Telemachon shoved past me, moving to Zaidu's side, and the jeers turned at once to cheers. The crowd scented blood now.
"Say nothing more, brother," Telemachon ordered his lieutenant. "Let's cut to the truth, shall we?"
Zaidu immediately nodded in wordless compliance, remaining at his lord's side. Lahior looked between the two of them, still straining to hold himself back with the leash of Abaddon's wishes.
"Lyrus!"
Lahior made the name an accusing growl.
"Your dog cost us the battle at the Thylacus Expanse."
Zaidu indeed said nothing, at least not aloud. I could hear the faint click of vox relays from his helm, as well as Telemachon's.
"In my absence, Sub-Commander Vorolas is invested with my full authority," Telemachon said calmly.
His aura rippled with the first stirrings of excitement, of anticipation finally ripening. Lahior kept his eyes on Telemachon.
"We have picked feats, gun imagifiers, vox archives, and sworn oaths that stand testament to your bastard sub-commander failing to reinforce us and leaving my vanguard to die."
Ah, how familiar, I thought, though my blood was running cold. I did not like the prickling amusement radiating from Zaidu. It was a piss stain of smug satisfaction souring his aura. This unfortunate scene had the ripe stink of premeditation.
"I understand your displeasure," Telemachon replied, as reasonably as I had ever heard him sound. "And I trust Sub-Commander Varelis's account differs from yours?"
Zaidu twitched one shoulder, followed by a tick jerk of his head.
"We fought to get them, Lord Lyrus. We fought. But the war gods more. They know nothing of tactics. They cannot hold to a battle plan. They advance too far too fast. Fire Fist's men, they were already taking savage losses by the time we reached them."
The Hiyor's response to this was, by his standards, rather calm. He spat onto the deck before Zaidu's boots, the acid eating through the metal floor.
"You're a liar, Zaidu."
Lahior followed the disrespectful gobbet with more accusations.
"A liar, a coward, and your word isn't worth a damn here. I am Lahior of the Ezekarian, and I say you lie."
He looked to Abaddon for support, but none came. I stared at Abaddon's passivity, and in that moment the die was cast. Lahior threw his axe. It hammered into the deck before Zaidu's boots. The raptor cackled his nasty excuse for laughter. Telemachon's aura flared with the caress of rich, snide delight. He was the one that stepped forwards, his hands on his sheathed swords.
"I hear your words, my dear brother, and like you, I am of the Ezekarian. As Sub-Commander Varalis's commanding officer, I accept the challenge in his place."
Lahior spat again. He wiped his mouth with the back of his gauntlet.
"I challenge your pet, Lyrus, not you."
"Indeed."
Telemachon turned fractionally to Zaidu, and their two helms bent together in melodramatic affirmation.
"Do you see the axe on the deck, Sub-Commander Varalis?"
Zaidu's reply came as a reassuring hiss.
"I do, Lord Lyrus."
The theatrical innocence in his vile voice was beyond grating.
"Then I accept the challenge on Sub-Commander Varalis's behalf," Telemachon restated. "Such is my right as his lord."
To his credit, or rather in an unsurprising sign of his own zealotry, Lahior did not hesitate. He drew the saw-toothed flensing knife at his hip and stepped forwards, facing our warband's finest warrior with a naked grin.
"Is that what you want? I care not whose blood runs for this, Lyrus, yours or that screaming dog's. It's all the same to me."
In the years to come, I would often think back to this moment. The sight of Lahior advancing on Telemachon, our warband's finest bladesman, carrying nothing but a skinning knife in his hand. Lahior is long dead now, fallen on Machan, as I have said before. But this is the man I remember, the grinning and confident warrior that faced the perfect swordsman carrying only a dagger. "Ezekiel," I sent to my lord, "do something before this madness gets further out of hand." Abaddon watched and said nothing. He looked weary beyond reckoning, but his eyes met mine and he nodded, finally giving me the signal I needed. I drew Sacramentum, and she flashed sacred silver into the strategium's sick light.
"Enough!"
My command was both spoken and driven into the minds of everyone present. The beastmen whined and lowered their heads in submission. The warriors regarded me with a mixture of reluctant obedience and resentment that I had stepped forwards to break the promise of bloodsport. Telemachon did not look at me.
"You have no right interfering, Luxandru."
Lahior shared the sentiment.
"Oh, you can have his pretty burial mask, Kaon, once I've carved it from his skull."
I cut the air between them with Sacramentum's shining length. "You," I addressed Telemachon, "are dueling no one on anyone's behalf. You think me blind to this transparent ploy? And you," I aimed my blade at Zaidu, "may expect my summons later. If you refuse to speak the truth in this matter, Zaidu Vorolas, I will tear it from your mind." I looked between Zaidu and Lahior. "Now both of you, back down." Zaidu obeyed at once, moving away with Telemachon, but Lahior did not. Spittle gleamed on his chin, and he watched their retreating forms with bloodshot eyes, still gunning his chain axe.
"Cowards!"
He drooled the word with a stalactite of saliva, then shouted it louder, setting off another chorus of cheers. I pulled Lahior aside, dragging him by the pauldron.
"You foolish bastard."
He winced at the silent knife of my voice, cursing me and snapping back,
"Get out of my head!"
"You foolish bastard,"
I said aloud the second time. Above us, Altio drifted in her tank, her nude form a silhouette in the amniotic fluid of her artificial womb. Several of the Syntagma stood nearby. The war robots and cognitively enslaved cyborgs she commanded were bristling with weaponry. The human and mutant crew knew to stay clear of her mechanical enforcers. To the beastmen clans that served us, the Syntagma were machine angels that obeyed the ship's soul. Lahior bared his iron teeth, his features twitching. A particularly painful spasm forced one of his eyes to screw closed and his mouth to pull to the side for two heartbeats.
"You're literally me, you uptight cur! The Shrieking Masquerade caused more casualties among my warriors than that God's cursed Daravek you failed to kill. Zaidu is lucky. I brought my grievance before Abaddon instead of killing him back on the Phylacus battlefield."
Luck had nothing to do with it. One of the ways Abaddon promoted unity was by overseeing disputes and duels between chieftains and warlords himself, rather than letting them slaughter each other out of his sight, according to their own whims. A subtle touch, but one of the many ways in which he sought to impose laws over our chaotic way of life. If nothing else, I admired his monarchical intentions. "Zaidu is baiting you," I said to Lahior. "I cannot imagine that you do not see that."
"I see it."
Lahior sucked his saliva back through his teeth.
"I'm not blind. That Nostromon wretch. Pull his heart from his chest, aren't
he?" "And if that challenge had been allowed," I interrupted, "Telemachon will fight in Zaidu's place. If Ezekiel had not ordered me to act, brother, you would be locking blades with the masked prince this very moment, instead of receiving a lecture from me."
"I'd rather have the duel."
The heel's left eye screwed shut as his cheek gave another wrenching spasm. Anger still rippled from him in an unpleasant breath against my sixth sense, but it was lessening now. A tide on its way out.
"The masked prince,"
Lahior said in a growl.
"I cut him to pieces."
I stared at him for several seconds, amazed. Truly amazed that he honestly believed what he was saying. Deluded or not, and he most certainly was, if he thought he could outfight Telemachon, Lahior was calming down. That was good. That was all I needed for now. I turned back to seek Moriana, only to see her slipping free of my rubriquet, moving forwards, a dark serenity spreading through the crowd around her. This lone, unaugmented human strode towards Abaddon, strode past mutants and monsters and warriors, and we watched her as if enspelled. Surprise was writ plain across many of my brother's faces. Even the mutants and braying beastmen, who had been so eagerly praying for bloodshed to erupt between their masters, for there was no finer entertainment than seeing their betters bleed, fell silent. Morriana walked to the base of Abaddon's dais, and there she stood, as tall and regal as a human could amidst a horde of monsters and mutants and gene-forged warriors, the least of which still towered above her.
"Ezekiel Abaddon," she said,
her gaze lifted to his.
"May we speak?"
He stared at her, and I will never forget how he showed no surprise at her manifestation. I do not know if he knew her from before our exile to the Eye, nor if he had been expecting her, but I do know that there was no surprise in his eyes when she stood before him. Perhaps he was merely too drained to react, but I do not believe so. There was something else at work that day. Perhaps the fate that our seers and prophets prattle of at such length.
"Speak,"
Abaddon bade her with a ripple of the talon. Morriana spoke. She told my gathered brothers and sisters what she had already told me, Amuriel and Telemachon on the graveyard world of the 16th Legion. Back on Malium, she had claimed to be a seer. More than that, she swore she had foreseen our arrival within Horus's tomb. Morriana had been on Malium for some time, drawn by its spiritual resonance and its place at the crossroads of fate. She claimed to know nothing of the downed Black Templar's vessel, and her aura flickered with truth when she made that claim. She likewise knew little of those black-clad warriors herself, deflecting our irritation by insisting she had far worthier tales to tell. We let her speak. As she did so, she led us from the crypt, back to the wreckage-strewn surface, and onwards into the wilderness of the eternal rust yards. All the while she spoke of how her dreams had driven her into the Eye itself, and then to Malium.
"I bring a warning to Abaddon, of a rival to his throne by the name of Tagus Darivec. More than that, I bring word of the Imperium as it is, not the Empire that you once knew."
The possibility of deceit was foremost in our minds, yet how could we resist such lore? She answered our questions, some clearly, some with evasions. The Imperium she spoke of was a realm unreal to us. In the centuries since we brought fire to the sky above the Imperial Palace, our names and deeds were not just consigned ever deeper into history, they were increasingly woven into mythology. Knowledge of the rebellion, a conflict she called the Horus Heresy, the first time I ever heard those words spoken, was ever more guarded and sequestered. Imperial authorities twisted what had happened in the war when they acknowledged it at all, and it was far more common to suppress any facts through sanction and even execution. Worlds deemed too tainted by the truth were declared forbidden ground, blockaded from trade and transit, struck from astrocartographic charts, and severed from astropathic communion until generations had passed. Some were even cleansed of life and resettled by harvests of colonists and itinerant pilgrim populations. Hope and ambition were no longer the currencies of mankind. In an age of spreading peace, the truth was becoming myth. The people of humanity's empire turned their devotion to soulful adherence in prayer and duty, while the Imperium's armies forgot how they had once warred upon each other, and instead turned their weapons outwards, to the Xenos races that had retaken their territories after the failed Great Crusade had dissolved in civil war. I listened in absolute awe. Nothing in the mists of her aura suggested any deception. If anything, she seemed to be taking care with her words, for fear of overwhelming us or provoking incredulity. I wished for nothing more than to tear her mind apart, ransacking her memories for all she had seen and all she had felt within this new Imperium. The only thing that stopped me was simple caution. She was adamant that she must meet with Abaddon, and I knew my lord would need to meet this outlander for himself. Morriana spoke on. Whole worlds had been reshaped, their continents given over to graveyards and necropolises, mourning not the slain on either side of our nearly forgotten war, but the more recent dead of the last several hundred years, the innocent martyrs of the God Emperor's faithful flock. The God Emperor. The God Emperor. Language cannot convey the effect those words had on me. I will do all I can to explain it, knowing that every explanation is wrong, for no wordcraft can truly shape an impression of what I felt the first time I heard that title. The God Emperor. Morriana said it again, when Amuriel asked her to repeat herself. He had stopped as if struck, his thoughts running so acidly rancid that I felt them pressing against my senses. Telemachon had been exultant, roaring his laughter to the sky, so gripped by euphoric revelation that I thought his twin hearts might seize. If you've ever walked an asylum's halls, you know that laughter. It is something beyond mirth, beyond elation. It is a release, a dam that breaks in the back of the mind to let madness pour forth, preventing the brain from drowning in poison. The God Emperor. I tried to repeat Morriana's words, but my mouth refused to give them shape. I was laughing myself. Telemachon could barely breathe. The laughter soared in and out of his faceplate's vocalizer, wheezing and wet, hacking as if he'd ruptured something in his throat. Amuriel stood dumb, trying to process what he had heard. Trying and failing. Yet Morriana was far from finished. She spoke on, telling us of the cult of the Emperor Savior emerging from the disorder of the rebellion's aftermath. Uprisings of this cult were commonplace on countless worlds, subsuming whole systems in this tide of new belief. The Emperor, revered as the source of the Astronomicon, allowed travel between humanity's scattered worlds. The Emperor, master of mankind, bane of aliens, the one true deity. A god. They believed the Emperor was a god. I knew how and why this had happened, even before she said another word. It happened as it always happens, as any scholar of their own species' history can tell you. It happened because the helpless masses were fearful, and because the powerful wanted unchallenged control. Every religion rises for the same reasons. The lower tiers of society crave answers and comfort, needing rewards in an afterlife to justify the harshness and grimness of their lives. And to prevent uprisings in search of better existences, their rulers institute a creed that keeps the masses obedient and compliant. Meekness, obedience, submission. These become virtues that the oppressed must embody in pursuit of a greater good or a later reward. To stand against the prevailing belief becomes not just philosophy, but heresy. Heresy worthy of execution. And so control is maintained by the strong over the weak. The God Emperor, I finally managed to say. There have been many times in my life since then that I have cursed that title or cringed at hearing it cried by his deluded followers. But that day, damn me for my naivety, I was laughing with Telemachon. A cruel, spurned mirth, not the amusement of the victor, but the bleak joy of the beaten. That laughter was a purging, like shedding an uncomfortable sheath of skin. Much of the Imperium already adheres to the word of the sect as gospel, Morriana continued. The temple of the Emperor Savior has a far wider reach and deeper roots than the petty cults that flowered during your rebellion. The Lectitio Divinitatis was a child's bedtime candle, compared to the sunlight of the beliefs now gripping the Imperium. All these thousands of years later, deep in what scholars name the Dark Millennium, the Ecclesiarchy grips the whole Imperium in an inviolate hold. Morriana spoke of its rise as an inexorable ascension, only a handful of centuries before its formal final adoption as the Imperial Creed, backbone of the Adeptus Ministorum, state religion of the Imperium of Man. And all of it, founded from the very beliefs that the Emperor had sought to destroy. Just as the Emperor had been betrayed by his sons, so too had the fool been betrayed by his own empire. Blind and rudderless without its monarch to guide it, the Imperium was devolving into superstitions and half-truths.
No wonder we were already close to being myths.
The word bearers won!
Telemachon was on his hands and knees in the dust, blood trickling from his unmoving silver mouth. He laughed and heaved and vomited and laughed, speaking between dragged breaths and violent convulsions.
The word bearers won! They eat dirt and drink shame. They chant prayers to the unwanted truth through bloodied lips. They lost everything, and yet they still won.
I did not fight for the word-bearer's vision,
Amuriel snapped.
None of us did. Our ideals were higher and worthier than the pedantics of divinity.
He looked at me as if expecting my support. I could not give it. What ideals could I claim, truly? I had fought in the rebellion because there was no choice. The wolves raised Prospero and stole the choice from us. I waged war upon Terra because my side was chosen for me.
What of you? I asked Moriana.
You are older than your physical form. Your soul is far older than your flesh. You have lived for centuries within this new Imperium, have you not? What then of your beliefs? She stared at me, measuring me by some silent criteria. I could tell from the flaring corona of her aura that my words had surprised her. I felt her thoughts shifting, following this new path.
I believe the same, she admitted. For many years I believed him to be a god. I was instrumental in spreading the belief myself.
Images, memories swirled slowly behind her eyes. Before they could resolve, she somehow felt me looking within her skull. A wall of mist swarmed across my sixth sense. I had met no other mortal who could defend themselves with such swiftness and ease, but I'd seen enough to confirm my suspicions.
You still believe it?
I know what I know, she said.
Her voice turned melancholy, but ironclad in the same moment, all doubt gone.
A god or not, his power renders him indistinguishable from divinity.
This is not the kind of theosophic discussion our liege lord enjoys, I warned her.
No. And yet you'll take me to Abaddon, whether you wish it or not, because you know he would never forgive you for leaving me here. There is more that I cannot say now. So much of what I know is only for Abaddon to hear.
For his ears alone?
For his ears first.
You expect us to allow that? She endured my doubt with a priestess's patience.
You'll have to accept it, Kaon. Not only here and now, but in the many years to come.
There was no unkindness in those words, yet they made my skin crawl. Telemachon was still coughing and chuckling.
Oh, perfect, he was saying. Perfection itself.
I had to help him to his feet.
Medic!
He called out mockingly to Amuriel as I lifted him to stand.
I fail to see what's so amusing in all this, said Amuriel.
Oh, the perfect jest, Telemachon replied, a grin in his honeyed voice. Don't you see? We are all part of the perfect jest.
All of this she told Abaddon and those of us gathered on the command deck. Telemachon was speaking softly among a group of his shrieking masquerade warriors. Lahior was calm, stunned to silence. Amuriel looked disgusted. None of us moved, none but Altio, who turned in her amniotic sanctuary, looking down across the crowd at one warrior in particular.
Ezekiel, she asked.
Her voice was a murmur from the mouths of 100 brass gargoyles in the rafters. The vengeful spirit itself, proud to stern, shuddered in sympathy with her concern. She was a weapon, a beast of war, and she feared for the soul of her master. Abaddon watched Moriana, his eyes glassy, mouth parted to show a glint of his filed, rune-etched teeth. He inclined his head, a reassurance for the ship's machine spirit, and a bid for Moriana to continue. The prophetess spoke on. I will not relay everything she said. Much of it you already know from Imperial annals, and a great deal more holds no relevance all these thousands of years later. To us it was madness strung together in sentences. To you it would simply be history.
Even as I relate the details now, my recitation conveys none of her moments of indecision or the halts within her speech. Mariana has never been a natural speaker. A listener, perhaps. It has been my experience that she hears everything spoken and uses it to her advantage when the time is right. But she lacks a demagogue's easy charisma or a preacher's fervent conviction. And yet we all stood rapt as she ministered to us with the unwelcome truth. The imperfections in her delivery that day only added to her sincerity. The hesitations in her cadence as she sought the right words only reinforced the importance of what she had to convey. And so we listened, drawn into the spell she wove. One of her most compelling habits was to speak without meeting her listener's eyes, her head tilted just so, her gaze unfocused, as though she was used to relying on senses beyond sight.
"I feel your anger,"
Mariana called out to us as she neared the end. Her voice was cracked and dry.
"I see your broken battle plate and the dried blood of your wounds, and I am here to share a warning beyond the words I have already spoken. I have walked the many webs of fate. The greatest threat to your ascension rises with you now. He hears the same call to unity that you all hear. He follows the same goals along far different paths. You know him as Tagus Daravec, the Lord of Hosts."
It would be an exaggeration to say that every eye turned to me in that moment, but many did. The Ezekarian, privy to Abaddon's plans, along with their closest warriors, they all glanced towards me. At my side, Lehior gave a dirty grunting chuckle at the sudden shift in attention, while I heard Telemachon's mellifluous laughter from across the chamber.
"Tagus Daravec," Mariana repeated. "In every future where he lives, Ezekiel Abaddon does not. In every future where he unites the legions, the vengeful spirit burns in the void. If he leaves the Eye and steals your fate from you, then your newborn legion dies."
The bridge dissolved into immediate uproar. Mariana raised her hands to bid the crowd to be silent, though her efforts were useless. The roars went on, adding to the percussive thunder of weapons beating against armor in militant rhythm. I heard and felt no paucity of rage in that bellowing cry. It unnerved me in a way little else could, for it laid bare the arrogance with which we draped ourselves. We had grown so strong, so used to our own victories, that the idea of defeat had become anathema. Perhaps, just perhaps, it also resonated a little too much like fear. I looked back to Mariana. Abaddon had descended to her side, and he lifted the talon high, lightning snapping between its bladed claws, bringing the gathering to a swift silence. He did not need to say a word. The gesture itself was enough. Mariana thanked him with a nod.
"Kill Tagus Daravec," she said to him. "Kill him, and take your place beneath the gaze of the Pantheon. This is your destiny."
That word again. How it plagues this tale. "Destiny," I sent to Amuriel in irritated disgust. But Ashokai overheard my psychic derision. He pulsed his disapproval to me from his raised platform above the bridge, where, as the warship's voidseer, he guided the vengeful spirit through the tortured heavens. "Do not lecture me," I sent back before he could do so. His attempts to convince me of the merits of prophecy had already failed over several centuries, and his reprimand was easy to ignore now. Prophecy, destiny, fate. The infinite power of hindsight. Prophets or prophetesses may speak whatever they wish and apply it like a soothing salve over the wounds of any event, once the moment has already passed. Prophecy is unreliable at best, and the embarrassing artistry of charlatans at worst. Abaddon, silent all this time, finally spoke. He said that which I had hoped to hear, the only words that mattered. "You speak of the Pantheon's gaze, but I will never bow to the forces that deceived Horus Lupercal." Mariana looked up at our lord, ferocity in her dark eyes.
But take as Tarevek will, and he will take your place on the paths of fate.
I felt like spitting. Surely my brother could not be dragged in by superstition and naked manipulation. Ezekiel, I said, must we listen to this? Sargon looked aghast at my interruption, as did Ashakai. Both were clinging to Moriana's every word. Abaddon gestured for me to hold my tongue, though there was no anger there.
Let her finish, Iskander. Let's see where this leads. Tagus Daravek has been a thorn in our side for decades, prophetess. But why do you so fiercely demand his death? What does he intend to do?
He intends what you intend, Ezekiel Abaddon. That which calls to you also calls to him, and already he makes ready to claim it before you can. Despite all of your ambitions, you are left with a simple choice. Wield the sword that you see in your dreams, or be killed by it.
Chapter 6. Ezekarium.
I know the cadence of that beating heart. I know the smell of that skin, the tang of those bionics, the scent of those consecrated weapon oils. Inquisitor Soroka. We meet again. Welcome, dutiful agent of the throne. Welcome to my parlour. Please forgive me for not offering you refreshment. The warded chains that steal my sixth sense and bind me to this pillar have savaged my ability to play the kindly host. I feel your gaze upon my eyeless face as keenly as these hexagramic restraints that sear my flesh. You have come for answers, no doubt. But to which questions? No, say nothing. Let there be no pretense between us. I know where you have been and what brings you back before me now. Your scrabbling, delving efforts into your order's deepest archives have dredged up mention of Moriana. Just as I warned you they would. You are beginning to believe me, are you not? You are beginning to believe the words of an arch-heretic. Moriana is one of those names that slither through the veins of history. Is it the same woman? Can it be true? Can it be that one of the founders of your sacred Inquisition is the very creature that whispered prophetic poison into my brother's ear? Can it be that the inceptor of your precious ideals chose later in her unnaturally long life to abandon them? Was she a warrior handmaiden of the Emperor who saw the light, or an archaeoscientific vizier in one of his laboratories who looked too long into the dark? Both? Neither? Someone before you has been seeking truth in the shadows. Where did you find this lore, Inquisitor Soroka? In whose archives were these words hidden? Your masters, perhaps? The man or woman that taught you and trained you? The merciless predecessor that fashioned you into the weapon of imperial lore I sense before me now? Oh, very well. Keep your silence. I will speak on. We made ready for war in the wake of the prophetess's words. The fleet mustered. We left garrisons at our grandest fortresses and arranged the barest bones patrols on the edges of our domain. But the heart of our sanctuary nebula played home to almost every able vessel in our armada, from the vastest battleship to the sleekest frigate to the bulkiest troop conveyor. The Ezekarian oversaw this great gathering, while Abaddon, in a move that shocked all of us, sealed himself away in seclusion with Moriana. The officers' perspectives on this were divided. Ashakai was captivated by the new seer, aching to speak with her, his scarlet albino gaze shining with a hunger no different to that of a starving man suddenly presented with a feast. He craved her insight and wanted nothing more than to follow the paths of fate at her side, learning all that she knew, seeing all that she had seen. Ezekiel has sealed himself away from his sworn inner circle, I argued with Ashakai at one point, as we stood upon the vengeful spirit's bridge atop his navigation platform, above the rest of the command deck. How does that not trouble you?
He has questions, my former master replied. She brings answers.
He's never exiled himself away from us before. "This is beginning to sound like a tantrum of an ignored child," Ashokai replied, his tone mild. But I would not be dissuaded by mockery, no matter how gentle or well-intentioned. Think of his degeneration these last years. Think of the voices in the warp that sing his name, practically praying to him. And now this? Do not mistake my caution for cowardice. He turned his white features to me, and I knew from the starved look in his retinal red eyes that I was arguing in futility.
"She has brought the answers our lord sought. The only good is knowledge, Sir Kandor. The only evil is ignorance."
"That is a saying uttered by as many fools as visionaries," I pointed out, "and an attitude that has led to damnation more than once. The last man to speak those words in my presence doomed our legion."
"Bye!"
Takura psychically cawed at me from its master's shoulder.
"Bye is frightened."
"Hush, crow, lest I feed you to my lynx. Nagual would enjoy that."
"You should not be afraid,"
Ashokai continued, as if his familiar had spoken true.
"See her arrival for what it is. An opportunity like no other."
"I do not trust her," I said, which were words I would say innumerable times across the centuries to come.
"Then don't trust her,"
Ashokai said as he turned back to the oculus, his long white hair falling to half-mask his features.
"But don't waste the chance to learn from her."
He had every reason to be ill-tempered and distracted, given his role in the war to come. He was the Armada's most gifted voidseer, tasked with coordinating and aligning the efforts of every sorcerer in the fleet for the attempt to break out of the Eye's pull. To even brush against his mind was to feel a dense web of overlapping murmurs that threatened to drag me inside, adding my presence to the processes of what must be calculated and the variables that must be considered. We were asking our voidseers to sail near blind and deaf through a realm where physical law had no grip, and to maintain the fleet's formation while doing so. In all the years of the Nine Legions' exile, nothing on this scale had yet been attempted. We were certain to lose several ships, and braced to lose most of them.
"Hezekiah will summon us when he wishes us to attend him,"
Ashokai insisted. He met my eyes with his watery albino gaze. Fascination for all that Mariana represented still burned there, no matter how distracted he was by the coming trial. I touched my fingertips to my heart in that old Chthonian gesture that had crept its way through the Legion, the gesture of one speaking the truth. "Sometimes I wish I had your faith, Master." The old honorific. Just this once. It made him smile before he turned away and resumed his work. Among my other contemporaries, between their faith, patience, or indifference, none of the Ezekarian shared my preference for caution. Telemachon reacted to Mariana's favour with Abaddon, much as I had suspected he would. His behaviour was nothing but parasitically loyal, to the point that he even stationed several of his raptors outside Abaddon's palatial quarters, ostensibly standing guard with Falcus's aphotic blade. It was a gesture, rather than a necessity, but as ever it was a cunning and valuable one. Mariana took note of it on her emergence, just as she noted those among the Ezekarian that showed less in the way of trust. We risked much as the fleet mustered. We lost territory that was left inadequately defended, surrendering it to the other legions rather than put up doomed resistance. The heartlands of our dominion remained as heavily patrolled as we could manage, but we paid in lost worlds at the frontiers. To our rivals, and indeed many of our allies, we practically vanished from the Eye, concerned only with amassing our strength in secret. Around the vengeful spirit, a fleet gathered of such size that even jaded veterans often stopped to stare at the host of warships at anchor in the murky void. Valakar, once guardian of Niobia Halo and now master of the fleet, was in constant contact from aboard his battleship, the Thane. His trust in Abaddon was absolute. He exloaded a stream of updates to the flagship with calculated efficiency, oversaw the muster in Abaddon's absence, and never once demanded to speak with our liege lord. We made ready for the war we had wanted to wage for centuries, yet I could not overcome my hesitation over the true reasons we would be fighting it.
the sword,
Mariana had said with such perfect assurance.
You have a choice, Ezekiel Abaddon. Wield the sword that you see in your dreams, or be killed by it.
None of us knew, not then, what the sword was. Abaddon had told us nothing before retreating into seclusion, except that we were to make the final preparations to leave the Eye. Mariana's words were all the more unsettling for the way she knew that which we did not. That sword. By the shifting many, how much of what we have done has its roots in the wielding of Abaddon's sword? Oceans of Imperial blood have run beneath that blade's edge. Rivers of our own have flowed because of it. We fought a crusade to claim it. We have spent an eternity slaughtering those that would take it for themselves. In Chthonian, the blade is called Asag, or Oblivion. In Nagrakali, the blunt mongrel tongue of Lahior's former legion, it is Skaravor, or Crown Render. In Tiscan Prosperine, the language of the city of my birth, it is Mal-Atar-Sai, the Shard of Madness. To Nefertari's people, it is Soritha, the Thorn in reality, a name spoken only as the Blackest Curse. These are all imperfect translations of the weapon's true name, for the blade was forged in no mortal realm, nor was it fashioned by mortal hands. In the wordless, soul-born language of the warp's winds, within the eternal howling of the demonic choirs, echoes the name Drak-Nayen. This is no word as the human mind would understand it, for it's not an utterance, but a concept. Within the eternal song of howling, weeping madness, is the fate-spun promise of the Emperor's death, of his imperium carved clean of ignorance and false faith. That chorus, that concept roared into demonic essence, is Drak-Nayen. This is what our languages try and fail to distill into spoken words, Usag, Skaravor, Mal-Atar-Sai. They are all aspects of the same thing. Drak-Nayen, the end of empires, a creature with its genesis in the warp-threaded conviction that it exists only to kill humanity's king. That which you call chaos, or the ruinous powers, that which we call the pantheon, this essence, this energy, does not obey us. It is not an entity unilaterally supporting us, or a reliable weapon that serves our needs. It uses us. It elevates us for the purposes of its own whims. It is a force of honesty, true, making us wear our sins on our armoured skin, but it is also the essence of absolute deception, shifting and warping whatever it wishes to pursue its own conflicting ends. It is the crashing, clashing energies of every memory, emotion, and agony felt by every human since the dawn of time, with the same suffering of countless alien species flavouring the resultant matter. It can be used, but only if you are willing to be used in turn. It can be worshipped and begged, but only if you are willing to risk damnation along with ascension. It is a force flowing through the veins of reality, one that chooses us and marks us as its puppets as well as its champions. That cannot be stated enough. It is not on our side. Many of us spend our lives fighting it and resisting it far more often than beseeching it. Abaddon's blade is one such aspect. As I hang here, chained and bound in the tender care of your Inquisition, though I crave to be back with my brothers and doing the War Master's work, there is one comfort in my captivity. It is a blessed relief to be this far from Drak-Nayen. I can still hear it whisper at the edge of my mind, even with my powers stripped from me. But I can no longer hear it laughing. No longer does it seep into the core of my being, a distraction and an infection. A demon only content when it is rending reality apart and leaving formless chaos in its wake. It is said that the weapon is only a sword at all because Ezekiel wills it to take that shape. I can tell you this is true. It is not a sword. It is scarcely even a demon. It is said among the legions that this was the gods' first gift to win Abaddon to their cause. If so, it was by no means their last. But I do not believe it was the first. No. That dubious honour belongs to another. Dracnayen was the second of the Pantheon's treacherous bribes. I have no doubt that the first was far more insidious, no less bloodthirsty, and calls herself Moriana. Abaddon maintained his self-exile for weeks, taking counsel alone with his new prophetess. When at last he emerged, he summoned us to Lupercal's court. Every one of the Ezekarian answered this call, even Ashokai and Valakar, who were both reluctant to leave their duties in the hands of their lieutenants for any time at all. I answered that summons with a sense of purpose I had not felt in some time. Ezekiel had promised me answers upon my return from Malium, and one way or another I would have them. That included enlightenment regarding this sword that Moriana insisted Abaddon was fated to claim. No more whispers of what may or may not be. It was time for answers. I would tolerate no refusal. The Ezekarian assembled in Lupercal's court. Here, where the failed War Master of the Imperium had gathered his lackeys and minions, Abaddon instead gathered his brothers and sisters. We stood beneath banners of Imperial conquest long since rendered meaningless by our betrayals. And in this great chamber where galactic civil war was first planned, we took a quieter council amongst the cobwebs. Horus had listened to cheers in here, with half of the Imperium chanting his name. We listened to the squealing of rats and the wet feasting sounds of things that had mutated far from their verminous origins. Whatever they were, they and the rats they had evolved from kept to the shadows. Sanguinius was there. Noble Sanguinius, Primarch of the Blood Angels Legion, was there in all his glory. And I saw Sargon hesitate upon entering. He considered the Primarch's manifestation an omen, and likely a bad one. Sanguinius was formed of psychically resonant crystal, as were all of the echoes of those slain aboard the vengeful spirit throughout its long history. Corridors and hallways across the ship were rhymed with these outgrowths, and they formed most frequently after battle or tumultuous journeys through the eye. I'd become accustomed to them. They had been the very first things we had seen when we initially came aboard the vengeful spirit in our hunt for Abaddon. They were mindless statues of hazy crystal, easy to dismiss unless one were foolish enough to touch them. They sang when touched, psychically offering numbed images and sensations of their deaths in last useless gasps of a soul's energy. The phenomenon had briefly fascinated me, but I soon relegated it as beneath notice. Sanguinius had died aboard the vengeful spirit, and here his ghost remained, as the warp-saturated steel of the ship's hull resurrected the Primarch, along with the other fallen. This was not the first time I had seen Sanguinius's crystalline shade. I had shattered it once, intrigued by the potency of the crystal shards. Then one of them served now as the smooth pommel jewel of my force sword Sacramentum. The crystal Primarch always regrew, sometimes here, sometimes elsewhere, just as the other crystal corpses across the ship always regenerated after shattering. Ashokai bowed his head as he passed the kneeling angel, paying respect to the agony etched upon that perfect face of stained diamond. Most of the others ignored it, save for Leor, who gave a pained grin at the sight. He idly swung his chain axe as he passed, the weapon's teeth briefly roaring, biting and breaking one of the immense wings from the body. I felt a twinge of psychic expression from the crystal ghost, a stab of false pain from the psi crystals. "Another glorious victory," I chided my brother. He turned the grin on me, moving to my side. There was no real amusement in his eyes. The first surprise was that Iliaster joined the gathering, his desiccated visage and patchy remnants of hair rendering him skullish and without humour. His sunken gaze drifted across those of us that had already gathered, and he nodded with a formality he would soon learn was unnecessary in this company.
I am Ezekarian,
he said in his desert tomb voice. None of us argued. He was welcomed with nods and a few fists banging against breastplates. He too halted at the sight of the now one-winged crystal incarnation of a dead Primarch, kneeling in torment beneath the banners of old wars. He processed what he was seeing, but rather than mutilate the thing, he simply walked around it, just as absorbed in the history hanging from the Gothic rafters. These meetings of the Legion's commanders were the most visible efforts to bring order from disorder. We would speak of supply lines, resources, materiel, formations, crew numbers, targets, duties. In short, we would behave as if we were an organized fighting force, not a disparate conclave of warband leaders bound together in a realm that defied physics and military logistics. Every warrior would speak their piece, citing their relevant contributions. Abaddon, in turn, would hold court in relative silence. He knew the value of letting his sub-commanders exercise their authority, and, as with any army, feed on their various rivalries. Officers were driven not just to excel before Abaddon and earn his sparse praise, but to exceed the deeds and usefulness of their kindred's warbands, impressing the Ezekarian and putting themselves in the running to serve the Legion's highest commanders. Abaddon was cautious with his compliments, but one truth was always in evidence. Those who quelled internal rivalry within their warbands, either by charisma, murder, or ritual challenges, those who could be trusted to fight reliably and not abandon battle plans at the whim of their own blood greed or to heed the calls of the gods, these were, without fail, the warriors who were most often rewarded. To them fell the positions of honour and glory within every assault, and the Ezekarian leaned most heavily upon them to secure victory. They became the backbone of the Black Legion. War-frothing raiders and treacherous mercenaries have their uses in any conflict, do not doubt. But Abaddon has always willed the Black Legion to be more than another gathering of howling slavers and psalm-chanting reavers. As common as those aspects are within our ranks, we do not let ourselves be defined by them. No true organization would be possible if we did. None of us were surprised when Mariana entered. The only unexpected element in her appearance was that she wasn't at Abaddon's side. She didn't make anything of her entrance, merely walking through the great double doors and taking her place near to Telemachon, who stood with calculated insouciance. She greeted him with a hand briefly on his vambrace, the gesture somehow sisterly. Their heads bowed together in murmured conversation. She smiled as she spoke, and his aura flared in response, a greasy brightening of bitter amusement. We stood in a loose circle, gathered but separate, as was our informal custom. Phalcus, the first, Sargon, the second, I, the third, Telemachon, the fourth, Lahior, the fifth, Ashokai, the sixth, Seraxia the seventh, Valakar the eighth, Vortigern the ninth, Amuriel the tenth, Iliaster the 11th, and Moriana, though she had said nothing of it, evidently the 12th. Ezekiel was last of all, stalking with slow, grinding growls of his Terminator battleplate. At gatherings of our warbands he would always take the focal point of attention, drawing all eyes towards him and calling out across the gathered masses. Here, among his trusted kin, he merely joined the circle we had formed. Once more I was struck by how unconscionably weary he was. If we had expected his time alone with Moriana and her serpent-tongued prophecies to illuminate and revitalize him, we were both right and wrong. Ferocity blazed in his eyes, the ferocity of reborn purpose, but it was the effort of a man on the very brink of ruin. Whatever had rejuvenated him, be it knowledge or something more sinister, it was also eating him alive.
"The fleet will sail for the Eye's Edge," he ordered. "We will declare war on the Imperium and the corpse that occupies its throne. If Sigismund's Black Templars stand in our way, we will break them. If Tagus Daravec opposes us, we will destroy him. If any of you have questions, now is the time." So casually did he state his galaxy-changing intent
that several of us smiled, myself included. But as expected, all eyes turned to me, so certain that I would be the first to speak. This time, however, it was Ashokai.
We are prepared, Ezekiel. Every void guide and sorcerer aboard every vessel in the Armada is ready to weather the storm.
I could see the weight he bore on his shoulders, and for a moment I felt a stab of sympathy. He fought a war I could not help with, one far harder than the games we assassins played. He had to lead the Legion from unreality into reality, breaking us free of a prison the gods themselves kept closed.
You have my trust and faith, Abaddon replied solemnly.
My thanks, brother,
Ashokai said, inclining his head. Abaddon looked around the circle.
Who else?
They all looked to me again, but I did not speak second either. That fell to Amuriel.
We sail for the Imperium, he said. An event we have all fought and bled to bring about is finally here, and every warrior in the fleet stands ready. Outside this ship a legion's worth of warships await our signal to sail. But I am asking you, brother to brother, why are we declaring war on the Imperium now?
Ezekiel looked across the circle at him, golden eyes locked.
This is what we have hungered for, he replied. This is what we have worked towards. You ask why we will declare the war now? Because we can, brother. Because finally we can.
That isn't what I'm asking. Do we wage this war by your command?
Amuriel indicated Moriana with a cursory wave of one hand.
Or on her whim?
This war is a matter of vindicta, Abaddon replied, using the High Gothic word for vengeance, knowing its resonance among our kind. It has always been about revenge, Amuriel. Our revenge. Moriana's appearance is merely a fortunate twist of fate. We would sail with or without her. You know this, brother.
Amuriel nodded, though not at once. The hesitation was telling, even if I had been unable to read the surface thoughts drifting through his aura. He trusted Abaddon, but Moriana was an outside agent, and she stank of manipulation, more than measured guidance. Moriana, for her part, said nothing. That was wise, for Amuriel's sentiments were shared by most of us there that day. We accepted her, or at least tolerated her, but we did not know her.
"Does it matter?" asked Vortigern.
His face was severe, his expressions forever cold. In all my life I've met no soul as serious as Vortigern of Caliban.
"I will fight by your side either way,"
he said to Abaddon, hand resting on the hilt of his sheathed sword.
"Whatever this human's motivations may be, they are irrelevant to us. Our plans remain unchanged, do they not?"
Lahior nodded, the movement a brief jerk of the head. Even back then he was beginning to lose control of his body, his nervous system at the mercy of the adrenal pain engine in his skull.
Matters to me, he grunted. Tell us what the witch said, Ezekiel. No secrets here.
Abaddon nodded.
No secrets here, he agreed. And answers will come. Armsmistress, you have remained silent thus far. I would hear your thoughts, if you would share them.
Ceraxia towered above us, looking down from within the shadows of her hooded robe. I could just make out the softly rotating eye lenses in that shrouded gloom, and the dark metal polish of her re-sculpted form. Her segmented, scorpion-like legs hissed and clicked with adjustments of minute pistons. Each of her lower limbs ended in a great blade that left scratching dents in the deck. This four-armed, spider-legged machine goddess drew forth from her robe the Black Templar's helm that I had recovered from Malium, and though it would have undoubtedly made a more emphatic point if she dropped it onto the deck, such was her reverence for its manufacture that she kept it clutched in two of her hands, close to her red-robed form. Not a trophy to her, but a holy icon.
"I care not for the poems of seers," she said,
emitting her words from a vocalizer formed by her fused, clenched golden teeth. A pale light flickered through this metallic fusion with every syllable.
"Or warriors reasoning for revenge. The fleet is ready, so the fleet shall sail. We have evidence of further wonders developed by the Martian Mechanicum in our absence from the principal materium. Examples of such treasures must be brought into our possession, unmade, remade, and knowledge of their form and function secured for our own use.
I cut through this with a chop of my hand.
With respect, Cyrexia, Ezekiel, tell us what we came to learn. Tell us what devours you, and what this seer means when she speaks of fate riding upon the blade of an unclaimed sword.
It's always you, Kaon, he said with a weary smile. My assassin and my accuser.
I am what you need me to be, brother.
He met my eyes, nodded once in acknowledgement, and then, at last, he told us.
Chapter 7. Vindicta.
I will not relate every word that passed between the Ezekarian in that meeting. So much of it you already know, and the rest you have surely inferred. Suffice to say that we spoke of the warp's whispers and their weight against his mind, and we spoke of the creature that cried out within those etheric tides, the creature that called itself Drak'nayen. That monstrous and deceitful entity's existence has its place in the tale to come, but it was not in truth the focus of our gathering. Primarily, we spoke of the coming war and the reasons it would be waged. It has ever been thus, even in the ancient world, when mankind was bound to the surface of Terra and battles were fought with spears and shields and riding beasts and warships of wood. Warlords have always considered the notion of a causus belli, the reason for committing to war. This was no mere raid we planned to harass the Imperium's frontiers. This was to be a clarion call, summoning allies and warning foes. This was to be the declaration of the Long War. And here, my inquisitorial jailers, we must speak of scale. There are those among the legions and scribes of what few imperial texts are permitted to exist that suggest the entire crusade was fought purely so Abaddon could claim his blade. This is brazen falsehood. Hundreds of thousands of legionaries would spill from the opening eye, with millions of mutants, humans, and demons in a tidal horde behind them. Most of them knew nothing of Drak'nayen then, and most know nothing of it now. They have their own lives to live, as pathetic and stunted as those existences may be. That false coin comes with another side, of course. There are those that believe we wished to surge forth and take Terra in the first breath of the war. Ignorance of this staggering scale is the rawest, rankest madness. The road to Terra is the most fortified, impossible series of battles imaginable. Wars are not fought in one engagement, but piecemeal, campaign after campaign, city by city, fleet by fleet, world by world. Even if we could bring our wrath to Terra in a single strike, what use would it be? The rest of the Imperium would remain unconquered and would descend on Terra to cut our throats while we celebrated our temporary triumph. Horus Lupercal had half of the Imperium's forces, and he still failed to take the throne world, deluded creature that he was. We have a fraction of a fraction of those galaxy-spanning war hosts. Horus began with, and lost with, more than we could ever muster. As the Imperium reeled in the wake of the rebellion, so did we. As it has struggled to recover all these millennia later, so have we. For all of the ways in which the legions are stronger than we once were, with our demon engines and never-born allies and the myriad gifts of our spiteful gods, there are twice as many ways in which we are weaker. Supply lines no longer exist, leaving our guns starved of shells and our warships hoarding diminished supplies of energy and resources. Few warbands can lay claim to the materiel of a Mechanicum cruiser or a forge world within the eye, and those that can must fight endlessly to protect it from rivals. Slaves die or lose their minds to the warp as easily as they breathe. Whole fleets scatter to the warp's winds, for eye space is far less stable than the material realm. Battleships die of thirst, fuel dry and crippled in the dark void, to be forgotten or swallowed as part of a macro-agglomeration space hulk. Warbands fight amongst themselves over ammunition, territory, plunder, even clean water. Champions that aspire to replace their warlord masters fight duels or sink to betrayal in order to rise above their former stations. There is no true agriculture in the eye, no harvest worlds supplying sustenance necessities. Whole worlds and fleets survive on the flesh and bones of the unburied dead, or the warp-stained roots of alien plants, or the corpulent bodies of mutant livestock. Commanders and warband leaders, even of the same legions, wage war against one another over matters of pride or power, or to win the all-too-brief favour and dangerous blessings of the erratic gods. Worst of all, recruitment for the Nine Legions is a matter of hellish difficulty. We lack anything like the reliable resources we once had to sustain ourselves and maintain our genetic lines. I could not even begin to estimate the number of bastard legionaries born after the heresy, forged with gene seed raided from Space Marine chapters loyal to the Golden Throne. And all of this is before the long and difficult journey to actually escape the clutches of the Eye, which is, as I have stressed, our prison and our punishment for failure, as much as our haven. The Eye's edges are where the storm rages hardest. Ships seeking to leave are torn apart in those reaping tides. Do you not think we tried? There is no swifter way to lose warships than by hurling them towards the Great Eye's edge. Perhaps I paint an ugly picture with all these truths. We are so much stronger than we were, yet so much weaker. We have such zealous purity of purpose, weighed down by impoverishment, treachery, and desperation. I will not lie, not even here, for deceit would be useless. The Black Legion's history carries its share of shame and bitterness, as well as the glories we clutch with such pride. Some Imperial scholars cannot imagine why we have not yet won. Others cannot see anything but defeat in our future. There is no clear truth. It is all smoke and mirrors, all illusion and confusion. On that fateful night, when Abaddon revealed the source of the dreams that dragged at his consciousness, it is not the gathering of the Ezekarian that stands out to me. It is what came after, when our nameless legion's warlords returned to their warships, and I alone remained at Abaddon's side. Even Moriana was dismissed. After their shared seclusion, Abaddon seemed to have no further use for her. At least, not for a time. "Kaon," he said as the others left. "When was the last time we sparred?" "It had been a great while. Years, in truth. My place was often away from the Ezekarian, and away from the Ashen Dead I ostensibly commanded. My place was wherever Ezekiel pointed on a hazy, shifting star map and said he required someone dead. We dueled, our swords live, power fields crashing and spitting each time the blades met. Lupercal's court was our arena, and we fought for hours beneath the dusty weight of Horus's failed rebellion. Ezekiel is a barbarian, a slayer. In battle, he is a warrior without peer, but his strength is in the force of his presence, the relentless viciousness of his assault. To meet him on the battlefield is to know, without doubt, that your life will end if you stand and face him. He does not fight, he merely kills. That's not to say he's unskilled. His talents are supreme, his focus inhuman, his speed supernatural. He is a force of murderous nature, his weapons never still, his eyes ever aware, alert to every shift and tension of muscle in his foe. In ages past, he would have been called a battle king, one of those ancient Bronze Epoch monarchs that fought in the front lines and inspired his men in the chaos of the shield wall, rather than a ruler directing a war from afar, or only fighting in tediously honourable single combat. Outside of battle's heat, no matter how he trains, he lacks the depths of brutality and viciousness that make him so formidable in true war. He's perfectly capable of dueling with a sword in training bouts, but it's never been his gift. Any one of the Ezakarian could, at their best, match him blade on blade. Telemachon and Vortigern would defeat him with relative ease. We fought alone, our armour illuminated in the flicker flashes of aggravated power fields. The banners above us flashed as if in a lightning storm, the breaths of displaced air from our colliding blades setting them gently waving in the false breeze. It's strange to think back to how he was then, before the Pantheon showered him with blessings.